All right, all right. Welcome back to the show. It's another mini-sode. How are you? How are you doing today? You feeling rested? You feeling good? You feeling like you're getting on top of your to-do list today? Maybe you're listening to the podcast while you're tackling a chore for the day. You're doing your dishes, or you're working in the yard, or you're wiping down your kitchen, putting things away. I do that these days. I used to listen to podcasts on my commute to and from work, and since that's not been a thing, I've had to find new time to set aside to listen to podcasts. And yeah, I've been listening while doing chores and stuff. Maybe that's how you're listening right now. That's a good way to listen. Maybe you're working out. Maybe you're exercising on a run around your neighborhood. Are you having a heat wave where you are, like I am? I know that my family in Utah said it's very, 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 very hot there. It's like record hot in Los Angeles right now. So that's fun. It's so hot that our air conditioning barely combats the outside heat. The outside heat is so oppressive that our indoor unit can scarcely fight it. But we're living with it, and we're doing our best to stay comfortable. Today, I wanted to talk really quick about propaganda. This is something that it's been on my mind for a while now, and I was thinking I would get a guest in here to talk with me about this, but I wasn't able to schedule anyone to talk specifically about this issue. Sometimes when I have a thing that I want to talk about, it's hard to know who to reach out to because there's not like people who are like propagandologists that I know, just made that word up, that I can just reach out to and go, hey, you're always talking about propaganda. Do you want to come on my show and talk with me about propaganda? It's easier to reach out to people to talk about something that they're already out there doing and talking about. So when I reach out to them and say, hey, you should come talk to me about such and such, they understand why I'm reaching out to them. It makes sense. But yeah, you know, propaganda, it's been a big thing this year. It's an election year. Propaganda is kind of everywhere. It's on everyone's news feeds, on your social media apps and whatnot. And I'm sure you're seeing plenty of it. I think that a lot of us like to think that we're pretty good at identifying it and knowing how to filter what's the biased or untrue information from the good and the, you know, altruistic information that's coming in with good intent. We like to think that we're pretty good at deciphering between propaganda and real, good, factual information. But one thing that just keeps ringing in my head for the last few weeks, the reason why I wanted to talk about this is just this idea that I am not immune to propaganda. And the second that I think I am, that's when I become really, really, really susceptible to it. So yeah, I'm definitely not immune to propaganda, and you aren't either, listener, dear member of the Blanket Nation listening to the show right now doing your chores. You may think you are, but I don't think any of us are, truly. And before I go too far into this, I want to sort of set up some definitional parameters of what exactly I mean when in this context of this conversation I talk about propaganda, because I think that the definition can get pretty broad, where we could just be talking about any information or any piece of media or art that's created with an agenda, or any piece of art or media or information that is created with a bias intended to sway the audience's opinion one way or another. And in that context, it's kind of like everything becomes propaganda. This podcast is propaganda. Every single piece of art ever created is propaganda. Like if at all the person creating it has any kind of agenda or any kind of like position or bias that they're coming from, we could go broad enough with the definition to include pretty much everything. But it is fascinating that when I do the, public speaking 101 and I look up the dictionary definition of propaganda, you know, you start your speech off like Webster's dictionary defines propaganda as, it says, I'm going to read it right now. It says, information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, used to promote or publicize a particular political cause or point of view. And even on, so I really lean into that, especially biased or misleading. And even on Wikipedia, It says, propaganda is communication that is used primarily to influence an audience and further an agenda, which, then this is the important part, which may not be objective and may be presenting facts selectively to encourage a particular synthesis. So those are the things that I really want to hone in on there, is like the misleading and the selectivity with facts, the proclivity to be selective with facts when presenting your argument with your piece of media or your piece of art or your piece of information, or your, you know, proclivity to just leave facts out altogether intentionally. So kind of the intentionally misleading aspect of it, I think, is what's fascinating to me and in this particular context of this conversation. And that's sort of how I want to talk about propaganda today, is propaganda. So, yeah, accepting the fact that it can be a broader definition of just any piece of information or media that is delivered with an agenda or a bias. Sure, okay, this podcast is propaganda, you got me. But I want to focus more specifically on intentionally misleading propaganda. Propaganda where the person creating it is intentionally skewing reality in order to present an argument that is not representative of objective truth to the viewer or the consumer. I do think that there is an important distinction there. If a person is coming at something with an agenda or a point of view, but they are being sincere and they truly believe what it is that they're saying, and they don't think that they're consciously misrepresenting facts, I still think that that person is capable of creating propaganda. And that's the other thing about not being immune to propaganda. We're not immune to it as consumers of media and information and art, and we're also not immune to it as creators of media and information and art. So you can come at creating something with all of the best intentions in the world and still maybe inadvertently create a piece of propaganda that isn't based on good information or factual science or history. And I think that happens a lot with like religion and stuff like that. But specifically today in this context, I do want to look at stuff that seems like it is intentionally created to create some sort of like misleading emotional response, you know, like to trick, for lack of a better term, the person who is consuming it into agreeing with the person who is creating it. So media or art or information that is created with an intent to fool you, to get you to think things that aren't true. Now, this really came to a head for me the other day. The other night, I watched a movie that I had been told for several years now to watch, to check out. It's a movie that I've also seen popping up in a lot of comments sections of arguments where people are talking about police. People are talking about like whether or not the police are overfunded, or what defunding the police or reallocating some of their funds could look like, to pushing their funds around to different community organizations that could maybe deal with some of the calls that police organizations get, where maybe we don't need to introduce armed officers into these certain situations. And a movie that popped up a lot in comments sections, interestingly enough, and that I heard from people in conversations where they'd go, oh, have you ever seen this? You know, was this movie End of Watch by David Ayer. And people would go, you know, I used to think that too. I used to think kind of like that ACAB thing, all cops are bastards, you know, cops are just a bunch of assholes. And then I watched the movie End of Watch, and I had a newfound respect for our boys in blue. I had a newfound respect for police officers after I saw that movie, because I realized just how intense their job really is and how they really are just undervalued and underpaid, and they really are just heroes. You know, they're out there putting their lives on the line for us, and we have the audacity to criticize them when they make a mistake, you know, instead of just thanking them for their service. When this movie came out in theaters, I remember not wanting to see it for this exact reason. I saw the previews for it, and I thought in my head, like, that kind of looks like a propaganda piece. Like, that kind of looks like a movie that was bought and paid for by the LAPD to make cops look cool and rustic and edgy and like awesome, but also like still like badass heroes. But I'd seen in all these comment sections people saying, like, actually, that was a movie that really changed my perspective. And I had some free time to kill, and it was on Netflix, and it was popping up. And I'm also interested in found footage movies right now. So I put this movie on. I watched it. Couple things right here, right out on the outset here. First thing is, fuck David Ayer. All right, David Ayer sucks. And I know that you're probably listening to this right now like, no, David Ayer doesn't suck. That's another piece of propaganda that's been sold on every goddamn one of us, is that David Ayer doesn't suck. Like, every time you see David Ayer's name attached to a project, like Hollywood, they put him out there in the trailers, like, from writer-director David Ayer. And people see that and they think like, oh, cool, David Ayer was involved in this. That means it must be good, right? No! David Ayer sucks, you guys. Did you? Okay, listen to this. This is David Ayer's Rotten Tomatoes page, all right? Because I know that you're listening to this thinking that I'm just being an Ayer hater, but straight up, this is David Ayer's, the movies that he's been involved with. The Tax Collector, he was the screenwriter. That movie has a 17% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Bright for Netflix, oh my God, that was a bad movie. He was the director and the producer. It has a 28% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It should be lower. That movie was really, really bad. He was the director and screenwriter for Suicide Squad. Now, Suicide Squad had a lot of producer, infiltration that kind of messed it up. But I still think it probably would have sucked anyway, and I think David Ayer sucks, and that movie definitely sucks. And it has a 27%, probably should be lower. It's really, really bad. He's the director of the movie Fury with Brad Pitt and Shia LaBeouf. That movie has a 76%. So if you think David Ayer is a good director, it's probably because of this movie or something like Training Day or End of Watch. Those are his three movies on Rotten Tomatoes that have decent tomato scores, is those three movies. Fury, I saw it for the first time the other day. It's fine. It's a fine war flick. It's nowhere it's not in the top 25 war movies ever made. It's fine. And it survives mostly on a strong performance from Brad Pitt, and especially from Shia LaBeouf doing some of his absolute best work. And that's the other thing, is like, actors, good actors, really good actors, love working with David Ayer for some reason. His movies always have really, really great A-list, top-of-the-line talent, for whatever reason, but the guy fucking sucks. We're going to keep moving down the list here. Sabotage, 22%. He was the director of that movie. I don't even know what that is, and I'm glad I don't know what that is. End of Watch, screenwriter, producer, and director, 85%. We're going to go further into it, but I can't even tell you how overrated this blatant piece of shitty propaganda is. It is such a dumb, bad movie. And it's only good because Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena do decent work in it. And again, he's got a great cast. He's got two actors with really great chemistry making things work that really shouldn't work and that still kind of don't work because it's such a, like, garbage screenplay. But I'm going to get back into that after I finish this list. Street Kings, he's a director and screenwriter, 36%. Harsh Times, screenwriter, producer, director, 48%. SWAT, remember SWAT with Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx? What a piece of shit. What a piece of dog shit. Also, are you noticing the theme here with David Ayer movies? So I'm calling End of Watch a big piece of propaganda. Are you noticing the rah-rah go America theme here with all of these, like, hard-hitting cop dramas about, like, how cops, like, these mean streets for cops, it's really tough, the job they have. But at the end of the day, most cops, even though they're kind of, like, rough around the edges, are heroes, man. They're out here fighting the good fight. They're out here in the trenches, man. David Ayer is a full-blown propagandist, and his movies suck. Harsh Times sucked. SWAT has a 48%. It should have lower. That movie sucks. Dark Blue, again, another shitty cop drama that I've never even heard of till I looked at this list, has 59%. I bet it should be lower than that. Training Day, probably David Ayer's best movie. If you've seen Training Day, it's really, really great. Denzel Washington won an Oscar for I think, Best Supporting Actor for Training Day. Should have probably won an Oscar for The Hurricane. He was nominated for that the year before, and Russell Crowe won for, I think, Gladiator or something. He won for Training Day, and he's fantastic. And Ethan Hawke's fantastic in the movie. It's this really great movie. But again, and I'm going to talk about Training Day a little bit later, mostly that movie survives on the strength of those two central performances. It really has not a whole lot to do with the talents of David Ayer as the screenwriter and the producer. It mostly exists on the talent of, and also particular thing to point out there is that David Ayer did not direct Training Day also. So he's got really, really great actors and probably a better director than him behind that one. David Ayer wrote the very first Fast and the Furious movie. He wrote the Fast and the Furious. So if David Ayer hadn't written that shitty, shitty screenplay, we wouldn't have that really bad series of movies. So we do owe the Fast and the Furious movies to David Ayer. I think that's all I got to say, you guys, to make my case that David Ayer really, really shouldn't have a career anymore. And he keeps getting hired and his name keeps being really big on posters as though that means something good and as though it doesn't instantly mean you don't want to watch this movie. It's probably a bad propaganda piece. So end of watch. Okay. So I'm watching this movie and almost immediately I know what I'm in for because the movie opens with a sequence where Jake Gyllenhaal and his partner are chasing these two cholos around South Central LA, and they're chasing these two gangsters around in a black Cadillac, and it's this really intense chase scene, and the guys in the black car are putting, you know, everyone's lives on the streets in risk, and you're really seeing, like, the setup here of, like, the bad guys and the good guys. And this is a big theme in David Ayer's movies. He really struggles to write characters that aren't absolutely good or absolutely bad. Even in Training Day, you look at that movie, it's like, great performances again, but Denzel Washington is just straight up evil for no discernible reason. He just is. And Ethan Hawke is just really, really good. There's no kind of gray between the two. Denzel Washington has fully sold his soul to the devil, and Ethan Hawke is the picture of what a good cop looks like. Now, in End of Watch, there are no bad cops, only good cops. And we see this right away. Right away, Michael Peña and Jake Gyllenhaal, they pin this black Cadillac that's running from them away. They finally get the car to spin around. They jump out of the car, tell the guys in the car to get out of the car and get on the ground with their guns drawn. The guys get out of the car and instantly start shooting at them with machine gun fire. So Jake Gyllenhaal and his partner have no choice but to return fire and kill these guys. So we cut to about 5 months later. Jake Gyllenhaal and his partner have been on leave because they had to deal with all the paperwork of killing these two guys. But we got to see in that scene that they didn't do anything wrong. They gave loud verbal commands after chasing this car for several blocks. Even when their lives were clearly in danger, they still said, get out and, you know, put your hands up and get on the ground. They still wanted to arrest these guys first. And then they were forced to use deadly force. So right off the bat, Ayer is establishing these rules that, like, here's how cops are supposed to conduct themselves. And the police officers in my movies never break these rules. They are always in the right when they have to kill someone. First scene of the movie is after this is Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña coming back to the force, and their police sergeant is addressing all of the police officers at the beginning of the shift, and he specifically addresses them, and he says, you know, welcome back, and he goes, you know, you guys know how this job is. It's really difficult. Sometimes we need to take lives in this job, and it's something we don't take pride in, and it's just a part of the job, and, you know, if it's absolutely necessary and there's no other recourse available to you, I want you guys to know that I have your backs and that I support you in doing that. I want you to know that this department supports you and that we are here for you and that we will offer you counseling if you need it after that happens. And he goes, but I have to say this, if you ever use your firearms in a way that it is not justified, we will not stand for that. That is not what we're about here in the LAPD. And that is not the kind of violence. It is like, it is such a blatant crock of shit, this opening speech. And it's so clearly directed straight at the audience and straight at your eyeballs and ears so that you can sit there and be taught this message that, oh, so that's how it works inside of a police precinct, is they understand that violence is a sometimes necessary part of their job and that it's unavoidable, but they also make it really clear to all of their officers that if they ever use unjustified force, that will not be condoned by the police office. That will not be condoned by the superiors, and you will lose your job and face charges. But here's the problem with that is over here in the real world where we have cell phone footage and just we have video after video after video after video after video coming in of cops killing people before giving, you know, verbal commands, before exhausting all of their options, we know that's not how this actually works. We know that police officers who probably aren't like bad people, who probably think of themselves as like they got into the job for good reasons and they really were trying to help. We know that all the time it happens where someone gets shot who probably didn't need to get shot. We have videos all the time of people getting killed who definitely didn't need to get killed. And we also have just stacks of evidence that time and time again, the result of these situations where we have you on tape killing someone when it was not justified and was not necessary, not only do you not lose your job, you don't face any charges, and you basically don't get punished at all. So this speech right off the bat that's meant to comfort me in the audience and let me know that, yes, violence is an unfortunate part of a police officer's job, but don't worry. There is a system of checks and balances that makes sure that if they ever use unjustified violence, they will be taken care of. This speech is bullshit. It's just not true. David Ayer is being intentionally misleading with this speech, and he does it throughout the rest of the movie. There's probably about 10 to 15 more scenarios throughout the rest of this movie where Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña have a violent encounter with a civilian, and they do everything every single time exactly right. They first give loud verbal cues, they command the person to get on the ground, and only when the person opens fire on them do they return fire. It's the same thing every single time, and all I could think the entire time I was watching the movie was, that guy would be dead. Like, there's a scene where they pull over to this truck that is a known associate of a drug dealer they had caught earlier in the film, and they suspect that this guy might be packing, so they come up with their guns drawn on the side of the car, and Michael Peña asks the guy to roll his window down, and instantly the guy puts a gun out the window to try to shoot Michael Peña, and he pushes the guy's arm away, and Jake Gyllenhaal comes up behind the guy and puts a gun to the back of his head and tells him to get out of the car and get down on his knees. All I could think was, yeah, that's just not how that would have gone. Gyllenhaal would have just shot the guy in the back of the head three times. I mean, and I'm not being cynical when I say that. Like, you've all seen the tapes. And if you haven't, then you're deliberately avoiding reality and you're kind of deliberately drinking Kool-Aid. I don't know. But we've got the tapes. That's not how that interaction goes down. When a Hispanic suspected gang member who they suspect might be armed does in fact pull a gun out, he's probably not getting taken in alive. He's most likely going to get killed. And this happens over and over and over again in this movie. And the message seems to be, these police officers have a really, really dangerous job. Yes, and they are constantly faced with the threat of violence, but they exhaust all options before using deadly force. And they only use deadly force when it's the only available option to them. And it creates this image that these guys are just fearless heroes who are just putting their... And like, here's the thing. It's not 100% untrue that they indeed do have a very dangerous job. And that a lot of the times they're putting their lives on the line fighting people who do wish to do them harm. It's just that the way that it's presented in this movie is so one-sided. And Ayer does all these little tricks in the screenplay, like the movie's rated R. So like the cops are always kind of swearing and like palling around, and they're kind of like rough, you know, like they, like Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña are kind of like lightly racist to each other. And I think the reason why Ayer includes that is to be like, look, I'm not going to paint them as Boy Scouts. I'm not going to say that they're just perfect. Like, they've got their flaws for sure. I'm going to make them seem like real people so that you in the audience think, oh, he's not trying to pull the wool over my eyes. He's really showing them as real characters. I mean, they swear and they, you know, they sometimes go on assignments that they're not supposed to go on. They kind of bend the rules and kind of go out on their own. They do things where they're a little bit rogue and they're, you know, vaguely racist with each other. So like, these guys feel like real guys, but when push comes to shove, they're heroes. And again, this isn't to say that all cops are bad guys and that there are no hero cops. Or that there's no, or that that everyone that joins the police force is a bad person. Because I don't even think that the police officers in these videos who are killing people unnecessarily are 100% evil people. I don't think that that's how the world works. I think that they're people who are in a dangerous job, who are in a often in confusing and emotionally scary situations where it's totally feasible that they could just make the wrong call. And when they make the wrong call at work, someone loses their life who maybe didn't need to. And I think that that's how it actually occurs more often than not. And that's a much more realistic and detailed and nuanced account than what Ayer produces in his movies, which is good guys and bad guys. There's literally a scene in End of Watch where Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña roll up on a party that a bunch of gang members are having. And guys, the gang members in this movie are so cartoonishly evil. It's impossible to imagine that these people have any redeeming qualities whatsoever. This movie's supposedly like grounded and gritty and real, and it's supposed to feel really realistic. It's a quote unquote found footage movie, and that's a whole other thing that I could spend 30 minutes talking about, is how Ayer like can't quite seem to commit to the idea of it being found footage. Like, he works in this like shitty device that Jake Gyllenhaal's character is in his free time, I don't know when that is attending film school, and he's like making a documentary about being a cop in the LAPD, and he's always carrying a camera around, but then like we're constantly going to camera angles that couldn't possibly exist inside the found footage genre. So you kind of go, oh, I guess it's half found footage and half real footage, and that's fine. I can just suspend my disbelief and go there, because, you know, all of a sudden like the camera will be at like a secret meeting of gang members who are all plotting out like, we're going to kill these cops, Holmes. And like, I'm doing this kind of racist Cholo accent because that's how it is in the movie. And it's just so over the top and so ridiculous. And these guys are just such like cartoon bad guys. But yeah, the found footage camera is happening at this secret meeting of bad guys. And you're thinking, oh, I guess we're just in movie camera now and we're not doing found footage right now. And then all of a sudden, one of the characters will be like, hey, Holmes, get that camera out of my face, yo. And you're like, oh, I guess the camera crew is here too, like at this secret meeting of bad guys who are plotting out like cop murders, and there's a person with a camera filming this. It's really shitty, and like just shows that David Ayer didn't know what he was doing with the genre that he was trying to make this movie in, and like didn't know how to make the screenplay that he wrote in the convention that he wanted to shoot it in, which just shows that he's a bad director and a bad filmmaker. But anyway, it's this whole found footage thing. Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña show up to this party one night, and the head of the bad guy's name is Big Evil. So again, there are no such thing as people who have, you know, nuance to their morality. There's absolute good guys and absolute evil guys. And Gyllenhaal approaches this guy and he says, hey, so you're the one that they call Big Evil, huh? And the guy goes, yeah. And Gyllenhaal goes, why they call you Big Evil? And I'm not kidding you guys. The line that is in this movie that has an 85% rating on Rotten Tomatoes is, because my evil is big, Holmes.
I swear to God,
that's what it says in this movie that all these people were telling me I need to watch. He says, because my evil is big, dude. And that's why his name is Big Evil. Why is your name Batman? Because I'm a man and I'm dressed as a fucking bat. Oh my God. Yeah, it's not a good movie. And everyone who told me I should go watch it, you need to watch it again. It's bad. You got sold a crock of shit. But that's kind of the point of this conversation, is like, I get why you bought it. Because Ayer goes to extreme lengths to make the movie seem like it's really doing it's best to represent what it's like to be a cop in South Central LA realistically. He wants the movie to feel gritty and real and grounded. That's why he's doing the found footage convention. That's why he's having it be rated R. He wants it to feel real. But the reason he wants it to feel real is so that you won't notice what a blatant piece of propaganda it is. And so, I don't know, I'm just interested in that kind of propaganda, where a person goes to extra lengths to make something feel like it's not propaganda, to make it feel like it's representative of actual reality, when in fact it's not. Because all I could think the whole time I was watching End of Watch was, this is not how cops behave. And I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of videos to prove that. And it's, again, I'm not saying all cops or anything like that, but I'm saying in this movie, all cops were good. There was not a single person who even made a questionable, you know, choice in a high intensity situation. They, even at the very, very end of the movie, the cops roll up on this band of gang members who have just murdered two police officers. These guys are armed with AK-47s and pointing them at the police officers, and the police officers surround them and they yell verbally, "Drop your weapons and get on the ground." And then the gang members go, "Fuck you, cops," and start shooting them. And then the cops light them up and kill the gang members. But again, it's like, that's not how that interaction would go. That's just not how that would go. And again, we just have the cops being absolute heroes who don't want to use their guns if they don't have to, and just the evil gang members who have no shred of morality in them and just not even a hint of a conscience, who, of course, you know, fuck you, cops. It's just, it's really ridiculous. And I don't know. It got me thinking about all the propaganda I grew up with, you know, all the movies that I've been watching for years. Air Force One came to mind. Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman. Great movie. You know, Air Force One, the president is flying with his family in his famed airplane, and it gets taken over somehow by terrorists. And the president has to, one by one, dispatch these no good terrorists, these do-batters, and, you know, culminating with the main bad guy, who he famously says, "Get off my plane," and kicks the guy off the plane. It's really badass. But I was just thinking the other day, I was like, what if like a movie came out in North Korea that that was like about like Kim Jong-un's like private plane getting taken over by like American terrorists, and Kim Jong-un like one by one dispatching them. And it was like the number one movie in the North Korean box office. And we all just sort of, wouldn't we all sort of like think that was ridiculous? I said this to a friend the other day and he was like, yeah, but the difference is like that movie would probably be about Kim Jong-un. It would probably be starring Kim Jong-un. And our movie was a little bit more, and he sort of like trailed off, and I was like, our movie was a little bit more hidden, like a little bit more cloaked. Like our propaganda was a little bit more like secretive. I mean, in some ways ours is more dangerous because we go through the extra effort to like make it not seem like propaganda. At least in North Korea or in Russia, they would just, I mean, yeah, Russia would probably do the same thing we would do. They'd probably make a movie where like a Putin-esque character who is based loosely on Putin has to, you know, like the Kremlin gets taken over by I don't know who it would be that would work for their country. Let's just say Americans for the sake of the simplicity. And, you know, one by one, this Kremlin-esque character this Putin-esque character who's totally not Putin, is going through and dispatching these guys. I mean, have you ever stopped to think about that? How insane that movie is, Air Force One? Like, what did the rest of the world think of that movie when it came out? Did people give a shit about this movie about the American president beating up terrorists on his plane? Like, and I could probably make a list a mile long that just goes on and on and on of different movies just like that that have existed that I think we just saw as like regular old action flicks. And I don't know. I think the whole point of all of this is, yeah, we're in a year with a lot of misinformation going on out there. And I think there's people sharing stuff about the virus and about the election where they genuinely think that the information that they're sharing is correct. They're not being intentionally misleading when they share this information. But the issue is the people who created the information that they're sharing, the people who created the infographics that are being shared and the videos that are being shared, the people who made these things probably were on some level being intentionally misleading. And I don't know if you guys remember this, like back in like November and December when NPR and Fox News and CNN and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, everyone was doing stories about coronavirus and about like, how concerned should we be about coronavirus? And everyone kind of kept using the metric that like, look, we probably shouldn't be that concerned. There's only been so far like 300 deaths from it. And the flu kills over 30,000 people a year, you know? And that was kind of the number. It was like a figure that was like 30,000. So lately I've been seeing people who are anti-maskers and people who are kind of like, conspiracy theorists about the virus, sharing infographics that say that the numbers are that the flu kills something like 190,000 people a year, and we haven't even reached that number in the U.S. yet, so why are we all freaking out? And I when I saw that, I instantly thought, okay, so whoever made that infographic is just lying. And this person who's sharing it right now on Facebook probably doesn't know that. They probably think that's an actual number, but like, that's not the number. That's just that number is a lie. So whoever took the time to make this graphic must be aware of that, right? And that means that they intentionally misrepresented the facts and misrepresented the information. And that's the kind of propaganda that I want to be on the lookout for. I guess you could make an argument that maybe David Ayer doesn't know that he's making propaganda with all of his like hard-hitting cop dramas, you know? But I think that he does know. I think it feels like his movies are funded, I'm serious, by the LAPD. It feels like there's such a strong pro-America, pro-cop agenda in his movies where he's deliberately not, you know, And then even like a movie like Training Day, it's like, well, Training Day has a bad cop in it. But it's like, again, I go back to that movie and it's like Denzel Washington's character isn't really a cop in that movie. He's a evil person masquerading as a cop. Ethan Hawke is the cop. Ethan Hawke is the true police officer. Ethan Hawke is the one that's an actual good guy. Denzel Washington's character doesn't even do police work. He doesn't even like bother with helping people. He doesn't like, he doesn't do traffic stops. He doesn't investigate murders. He doesn't, he doesn't really do anything. He just kind of goes around like extorting people and committing crimes all day long. So he's not really a police officer in that movie. And again, he's not a character with any nuance. He's just a bad guy. And you know, it could be argued that the use of like the found footage convention was done as a means to create more stakes, to make it feel real. You know, this is a thing that's it's done all the time with thrillers and horror movies. Like the found footage thing is most commonly done either in comedies, I don't know why, it just sort of works, that mockumentary style, or in horror movies. And it's done with horror movies like it started off with the Blair Witch Project and then Paranormal Activity and all that stuff. It's done there in order to give it a feeling of authenticity, which ratchets up the terror of it, the plausibility of it all. But the difference, and you could argue that that's all that David Ayer is doing. It's just trying to make this stuff feel more plausible, to give his story more stakes and to get you as the audience more invested in the story. And that's all it really is. He's just trying to tell a more effective story. The important difference I think here is that, you know, people who make a found footage horror movie about a haunted house aren't trying to actually push an agenda to make you think that this movie about a film crew that spent the night in a haunted house and brought their cameras in with them and then got haunted by these ghosts. Like, there's nothing they're really trying to push on you other than just an experience of just having a fun time at the movie theater and getting scared. And the found footage things helps it ratchet up the tension and the stakes so that you get more scared. And that's all that is. Whether or not Ayer intends this or not, I think he is intending this, but even if I give him the benefit of the doubt, the result of his movie is that people in comment sections, when having conversations, real-life conversations, about the real-life behaviors of actual police officers, are referencing his film. People are referencing his film as proof that police officers are actually good people and we should cut them all some slack. So what's the harm in that? You know, what's so wrong with people getting a message like that? Again, I've said this several times in this episode, but I'll say it again because sometimes I need to repeat this stuff a lot. I'm not talking about all police officers here, and I'm not saying any of this to paint all police officers with a big wide brush. But what I am saying is that this stuff is happening right now. Okay? Jacob Blake was just shot on camera in the back 7 times by 2 police officers in Wisconsin. Just happened. It just a few days ago. And yeah, you could watch the video and say, hey, they were giving him commands to stop, to stop moving. You know, but it's like, you watch that video and whatever the intricacies are of what's going on there, it's all too familiar the way this thing unfolds. That without actually seeing him reach for a weapon or really feeling like there's a clear and present danger or a threat, it's enough that he's just not obeying their commands for them to unload 7 shots into this guy's back. They didn't even know that he had 3 kids in the backseat of that car. They acted so quickly. And again, I'm not saying that the police officers in this video are like evil people. They're not characters in a David Ayer movie. They probably are people with families of their own, with kids. But, you know, Jacob Blake is also not a character in a David Ayer movie. He's a real person with real complexity, you know? And you can look at the footage and say, hey, they were giving him clear commands and he wasn't obeying their commands. But if that's where your brain goes, I think you've been probably getting hyped up on a little bit of bad propaganda, because you have to ask yourself the question, does the guy deserve to be shot? He's not dead yet. He's in stable condition in the hospital, so he hasn't been murdered yet. But does he deserve to be shot 7 times at point-blank range in the back in front of his 3 kids because he was frustrated and he was trying to get something out of his car to show to the police officers, or he wasn't hearing their commands because there was a fight going on behind him? It was a very intense situation. There was a lot going on. But whatever the circumstances is, if you can watch that and feel like that guy deserves to get shot 7 times, because, hey, you know, the rules are the rules. I don't know, man. I feel like if you're more emotionally convinced of an argument by a fake movie that's not representative of actual reality than you are of an actual video, of an actual interaction, with all of the complexity that goes into that between some actual human beings, where 2 human beings are choosing to draw loaded weapons on another person because he's kind of acting in a way that makes them feel on edge. Why weren't their tasers out? Why did they have their guns out? There's so many other ways that they could have de-escalated that situation than instantly pulling out their guns. And yeah, I really do think that stuff like this is directly influenced by shitty movies like End of Watch. And there's other movies like this that are about, like, you know, police interactions with the public. Fruitvale Station is one that I've referenced on this podcast before. It's a movie about Oscar Grant, who was kind of like the first person to be shot by a cop on cell phone footage as the evidence used in the case. And in that movie, I mean, I wouldn't call that movie propaganda because they pretty much just do a shot-for-shot remake of what actually happened. That's all that is. And it's incredibly emotionally effective. It's devastating, but it's just reality. It's just what actually happened. And if you're just operating under this sort of confirmation bias of just like you already have decided that you just want to be on the side of all cops are good guys and heroes and I don't want to hear any criticism of cops, then I guess end of watch is your movie, but you know, and you're just looking for stuff that validates the way you actually feel. Because there's that, there's this thing that's not representative of real life, and then there's actual real life footage of people getting killed by police officers. And yeah, police officers have a hard job and a job that frequently leads to violence. But if you can watch a video and clearly see that a person is being murdered who doesn't need to be murdered, that's a problem. And I'm not saying that it's David Ayer's job as a filmmaker to address that problem in his movies, but I am saying that by blatantly misrepresenting that issue in his quote-unquote realistic found footage cop movie, he's intentionally misrepresenting reality in order to sell an image of something that isn't actually true. The point is, I think that there's lots of people out there with prominent positions in media and in film and television and in art who have an agenda and a bias that they're willing to lie for in order to push. Most people who are storytellers and content creators and artists have an agenda. That's something we talked about at the beginning. Most people have an agenda or a point of view or something that they're trying to like say or a message or a conversation that they want to start. So with that broad definition, yeah, everyone's a propaganda artist. But not everyone is willing to utilize deliberate untruths in order to propagate their message. And that's the more honed in definition of propaganda that I think we need to be on the lookout for. And how do you know if these infographics that you're about to share on Facebook are propaganda or not? Well, I mean, Google's a thing. Some of these things that people are sharing, some of these infographics, it's like, did you even look this up? Or did you just see this like shared by a person that you trust and you just hit share too? And again, I am not immune to propaganda. I'm not immune to this. I see things shared on people's Instagram stories all the time where I'm like, oh, that's cool. And I don't probably do as much research as I should before I click share sometimes. You know, it just seems real. If it's in line with my existing values and things that I already want, I'm probably less reticent to look it up. And that's the other big problem with propaganda right there is confirmation bias. Is like, I'm bringing my own biases and my own point of view already into my consumption of this material. So if I'm already on the lookout for a movie that makes me feel good about cops and that makes me feel like cops are heroes, I'm going to get all teary-eyed in End of Watch when Jake Gyllenhaal says, he was my brother. 4 years of acting school, you guys. Did you think I was crying just then? Did it sound like I was crying? I wasn't. But I actually did get choked up when I watched that in the movie because, dude, Gyllenhaal crushes. It's a good performance. I'm not taking anything away from Gyllenhaal and Peña here. But the movie was a crock of shit intended to make you feel like cops are really, really, really good people and only really, really, really good people would become cops and cops never make mistakes or kill people by accident that they shouldn't kill. And when they do, they absolutely get dealt with in an appropriate way. And that's the message of that movie. And that's why I kept seeing it in comment sections where people were debating about whether or not we should defund police or reconfigure police duties. And people kept saying, have you seen End of Watch? It really changed my mind. Well, yeah, of course it did. That was kind of the whole point of the movie. Was to make you think a certain thing by presenting you with less than honest depictions of everyday police activity. Okay, so that's my rant on propaganda. You know, it's a mini-sode, and as so frequently happens on here, I like to debut little sneaky surprises on these things. So I got one for you today, my people. I got a new single. It hits streaming platforms Friday. I know I said that the last one was going to be the last single before the album comes out, but I'm working with this PR firm in New York, and they were like, let's do one more single before we release the album, so we just have a little bit more of a buildup while we're doing this big rollout. So we're doing one more single, and it's called The Comeback. And, you know, this album, I wanted this album to have a lot of energy behind it. Historically, in the past, I've written very melancholic, kind of self-deprecating tunes, and I wanted the energy behind this album to be bigger and more joyful and more colorful. And this song, it's the second song on the album, and it kind of is like technically the first song of the album. There's almost like a pre-album song that happens first, and then this song comes roaring in that you're about to hear right here. And it's just, it's kind of like a celebration hymn of rejuvenation and spiritual rebirth. This is sort of how I felt about getting sober and about sort of leaving the fog of 10 plus years of depression and anxiety. I felt very celebratory and joyous, and that kind of all went into this song. And lyrically, specifically, if you go and look at my 2018 EP, You're Just Killing Your Poor Mother, there's a song called I'm a Carrier that's all about how I am a carrier for self-conscious feelings and for depression and for anxiety, and you should keep your distance from me because I'm contagious. And if you come near me, my depression and my anxiety will rub off on you, so you better just cross the street if you see me. And those are the lyrics to that song. So I thought it would be fun because that EP was supposed to be kind of me putting to bed my sad songs and my songs about depression and everything. And this album was supposed to be kind of the new chapter in my life. So this song has a lyrical callback to that song. So that song says, if you see me, the song I'm a Carrier has a lyric that says, if you see me on the street, it's best to cross to the other side. Basically, because I'm contagious. This song, The Comeback, in the chorus says, and if you see me this time, come on over. I think it's I'm just fine or something. I should know my own lyrics. But it's a direct reference to that song. It says, I'm not contagious this time, and I'm not carrying anymore. I've just got this peace of mind. So that's the song. I love this song. This album has all these different colors and all these different styles. And this is just like, I don't frequently sing like I sing on this song. I don't usually play like I play on this song. It's just like a hard rock anthem, and it's a lot of fun. And thanks for listening today to my little piece of propaganda. And we'll see you back next week with another guest and another full episode. Love you so much. Okay, this song is The Comeback, mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music, marmalademusicslc.com. You can go there, get 20% off your first project, and they will do a great job the way that Chris did on this song, The Comeback, streaming everywhere on Friday. Here we go.